For me, it's too easy. It's like, again, I feel like there's like a Pavlovian thing. I don't even enjoy it. I'm just doing it because it's there.
Welcome to another episode of Jabber and the Drone, the movie review podcast that politely disagrees to agree. From Portland, Oregon, you are Richard Wally.
California, you are the Los Angeles area. You are Cassidy Robinson.
I am. And last weekend we didn't have a show.
Mm-hmm.
I attended the Long Beach Comic Con.
Right.
And this weekend, just this past weekend, you attended the Rose City Comic Con in Oregon.
Rose City! Yeah, that's true. I did that. It was good.
So we both got our geek on.
I geeked all over the place.
How was your con experience? Did you volunteer this year?
Yeah, I did volunteer. I really it's run by a local couple. It's not like some big corporate wizard world thing, and they've always been really good to us, and we've really always enjoyed doing it. I work in registration, and I check people in so they can put their tables down and stuff like that, like the artists and guests and
yeah.
things like that. And so, yeah, it was a hoot. I did go to a lot of panels this year, and I did go on the showroom floor quite a bit. But
oh, good. So you didn't? It wasn't work the whole time.
No, last year I pretty much was in the room like almost the entire time.
That'd be a bummer.
But this year I worked during the busy hours.
Mm-hmm.
So I actually worked a lot on Friday, letting people in, and then I did some Saturday morning, and then I did some Sunday night. So
yeah, and I know it's one of the bigger Comic Cons in the Northwest. Is it pretty sizable? Is there a lot of people?
It's been doubling almost every year. We actually talked about this because me and my wife, we've been going like every year, and it was interesting because the first year was in Doubletree, which is like this little, like it's like the size of a skating rink. It's really small.
That's like at the bottom of a hotel.
Yeah. And it was like this was like, I don't know, like 4 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Is all. And now this time it's like pretty much the whole convention floor.
Mm-hmm.
And I think on Saturday. I didn't hear the official numbers, but I heard kind of at like out of the corner of my ear from somebody, like it was about like 40,000 on Saturday. So it was sizable.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah. This year, I mean, this is the first time I've ever been to the Long Beach Comic Con. I went to WonderCon in Anaheim earlier this year, and that's, well known as being one of the larger mini cons, if you will.
Sure.
But this one didn't seem that much smaller. There seemed like maybe more elbow room when walking around. But the convention center is about the same size in Long Beach.
Mm-hmm.
And it's by far, since I've been to the San Diego Comic-Con back in 2008, it's by far the longest line I've ever had to wait in.
Really?
It was ridiculous. And I don't think it was just because there were so many people. I think they just did not have their shit together as far as their line situation goes.
That can happen, yeah.
But like I walked up the stairs, found parking, whatever, which that was a nightmare. And then I walked up the stairs to the Comic-Con, and there was like two rows of lines going for a ways.
Mm.
And I was like, holy crap. So people were taking pictures with a Batman. And there was kind of a big break in the line, so I was like, I could just slip right in here and nobody would notice. And I was standing there for a little bit, and I wanted to make sure I was in the right line, so I asked the people who were in front of me. I was like, this is the line to get in, right? And she's like, Oh, no, this is the line if you don't have tickets. If you already have tickets, you want to be in this other line, which was next to me. And I'm like, okay, where does that start? And she's like, well, it starts over there and then it wraps all the way around two times and then it comes back again. And I'm like, are you effing serious?
What is this for?
This was just to get in. This was just to turn my voucher that I printed into a pass.
Oh, so this is just your pre, your like.
Yeah, this is before you even enter the building.
So this is the pre-sale line. Okay, gotcha.
Yeah, and I already bought my ticket online a few weeks prior. And so I ended up waiting in that line for an hour, a full hour.
See, I've done that at other shows, even pre Comic-Con being big. I've waited in show lines that have been pretty long, so.
Well, but the rest of the story is when the line finally wrapped around twice, like she said it would, I was in the right line the first time I was there. Oh, and I would have got in like 15 minutes if I had stayed in that line.
Well, that's a thing, too. Like,
if I had not been honest.
Yeah. You should have just not been honest. But well, that's the real lesson.
I thought I was in the wrong line. She probably knew.
I don't know. I don't know about that. That's a little paranoid, don't you think? She knew. She was ruining my life. I know she was.
I'm certain of it.
Okay. Well.
But we had fun. I didn't spend a lot of money because I don't have a lot of money at the moment. I bought a Nightmare on Elm Street 3 mini poster. I got a little bit of swag, as you usually do if you walk around on the floor enough. Got to talk to some cool people, artists, and I mentioned to you before the show, I talked to another podcaster. We may or may not have him on at some point. And yeah, so it was just, I don't know. I have enough fun just kind of window shopping. I don't have to like buy a lot of stuff.
Right, I look through kind of culturally kind of purveying. It's
like, yeah, you just kind of see what's there. And what's cool about the Long Beach Con versus WonderCon or the bigger ones is it's mostly local artists. So it's a lot of artists who are either in the Orange County, Long Beach area or LA, rather than, you know, the big writers and artists that come from other places. The guy who wrote Elephant Man, he was there and we went to we went to his panel, and then we also talked to him at the booth. You know, he was really cool and chill.
Yeah, no, we got a the good thing about Portland specifically is it's a mixture. Like, you get a lot of like local artists and stuff like that, and then but then you get a lot of like, because we've got Dark Horse and Oni here specifically, and so you get a good mix. And if you're a fan of Dark Horse, I think it's a really good area to be in. Specifically, we got to talk to who are some of the fun ones we got to talk to. Well, the only book I bought because we were on a budget / we're having spatial issues where to put the damn things. we bought a little one called Goners. It's a little horror teeny bopper thing. And I always kind of like those, so this is an Image title.
Okay, yeah,
it's a little horror thing about some kids in a town, and it's got some weird monsters in it. I don't know, I haven't read it yet, so it'll be exciting.
Right.
Let's see what else. Jeff Parker is always entertaining.
What does he do?
Jeff Parker has written a lot of superhero stuff. The thing I like him most for is not a very well-known title. I mean, he's writing like Shazam Convergence or something, but I don't know. He's written, the thing I like him for is called The Mysterious Unfathomable.
Yeah. You're looking at your books right now, aren't you?
No, I wouldn't do that.
I can hear when you lean back and you're looking at your bookshelf.
I'm crappy at names, so I what's funny is the art is very, very memorable about that. So I got to talk to him about that title, and then but I mean, he's done a lot of Marvel and DC stuff. He's kind of just a funny guy in general.
Like, yeah.
I almost am just as drawn to him as a person as I am his stuff. But his stuff is good, and it was I'd never seen him in a panel, and there was literally a panel that was just him and a dude kind of interviewing him. It was called the Parker Brothers Hour. And because the guy interviewing him is apparently kind of Twitter famous or something, and just asks Jeff Parker a lot of questions.
That's cool.
And so it was just him, and just listening to him talk about kind of like his, like, hear him talking about like Walt Simonson and some of the comics. He really knows his stuff, and it was really cool to hear that. But then I got to see some of, you know, the Dark Horse people like, oh gosh, making me do names.
I'm not making you do anything.
Well, I'm telling a story. You told me minutes. I have to be Marc Maron when I do the podcast. You told me I can't be misanthropic and not tell stories. So, Paul Tobin is his name. He did, he's done this book for the last couple of years called Colder. It's also a horror book. Surprise, surprise.
Yeah. I think I've heard you talk about it before.
Yeah. It's weird. That's why I really like it. It does some weird stuff. It's like in a lot of horror, they always have like a thing that they're into. Mm-hmm. Right. And specifically what it's about being crazy. And so it was pretty, it gets to play a lot in the kind of like fantastical kind of horror land, mm-hmm. which in comics they can really push that. And it's a lot of fun.
Cool.
But yeah, no, the con in general was good. There was Tim Sale and, you know, bigger people there, but
yeah, there's a Kamikaze, Stanley's Kamikaze, which is another mini con, which happens in downtown LA.
I'm aware of it.
That's happening on Halloween weekend, and I think me and my friends are going to go to that. And I know.
No.
Why no?
I don't know. Actually, no. I just want you to go to Universal Studios Hollywood for their.
Yeah, it seems kind of weird to go to a convention on Halloween, but at the same time, at least I'd be doing something on Halloween, which is usually what I don't do. Plus, I celebrate Halloween all month.
Well, you don't have to. You don't have to. No, I'm really serious about going to Universal Studios, Cassidy. For me. Take pictures.
Live out your dream.
Yes, live out my dream. No, they do amazing stuff, and their little haunted alleys and stuff are a lot of fun. Or go to that really crazy one where they grab you and put you in, like, torture
in
devices.
In San Diego, where you go through the whole hostel experience.
Actually, I'm
going to... of getting killed.
Maybe I'll try to force Keith to do that, actually.
You should. I think he already knows what it is, but it'd be great if you could trick him into it.
I'll do that.
Yeah. Okay, well, let's get on with the show.
We do a movie review podcast.
This isn't a comic book podcast, per se. Today, we're going to be reviewing M. Night Shyamalan's The Visit. And at our Netflix homework, the end of the show, we're going to be reviewing the Hungarian film White God. But before we do that, we have a few movie news items that we haven't got to in a little while, and we'll try and catch up on some of this stuff. What was the first one you had?
The first one I've got is actually, so Legendary has Godzilla, and then when they moved to Universal, they got King Kong. Well, the big news is right now is that Legendary just moved King Kong from its place at Universal to Warner Brothers.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this has a double connotation. The first one is we may be seeing a Godzilla versus King Kong movie.
Another one. Yes.
Yes. Maybe this one will be more serious. I don't know. The first one was like a comedy. I learned it was a comedy. I'd always laughed at it.
Yeah.
But then I felt better because now I'm laughing at a comedy instead of something silly.
Right. I think it might be a little bit of both.
Yeah, but the new one, I don't foresee them going funny.
No, I think it's going to be a big, which is, you know, isn't necessarily a bad thing, but I think it's going to be a big kaiju battle, basically.
And there's nothing wrong with that. I don't even need people. Just give me an hour and a half of two things fighting.
No context, just, you know.
The Protector?
Right.
Like that. That's what I want.
That at least had like a little bit of a framing device where he's this a Thai kickboxer who protects elephants and has to travel to Australia to get an elephant back.
Well, yeah, no, what you do is instead of put the fight scenes, you just have those elements, the Protector, and then kaiju battle in between, and then you go back.
I would definitely watch a King Kong versus Godzilla with Tony Jaa as the star. Like, flip kicking random stuff.
Kaiju in the junk.
Right.
Because the face is a little high. So I was like, what's the most likely? I mean, the junk is a little high too, but
yeah, he could do a backflip kick probably high enough to get King Kong in the nuts.
Yeah, that's what I was saying.
Right.
I mean, he'd have to do it off the knee, then off the thigh, and then. But I think he could do it. Anyways, that was a tangent. No. The other thing is too is apparently there are some rumblings that Legendary did this move to Warner, back to Warner, because they moved from Warner to Universal to get away from Warner, but now they're going back to Warner, and there's been some rumblings that it hasn't been all flowers and daisies and stuff.
I think
Universal and Legendary,
just judging from the output, you know, because when Legendary first started, there was kind of this idea that it was going to be sort of like prestige blockbuster, you know, because they were doing a lot of Christopher Nolan films and whatever.
Yeah.
And like the idea was like they're the smart blockbuster. And then after a while, it seemed like they were becoming less and less interested in that and becoming a little bit more and more like a high budget Lionsgate. And I kind of feel like they're having a lot of trouble either within the company's creative side, and having a hard time maintaining their brand.
Well, and that move, I'm not sure completely, but I mean, I do know that they, however you feel, they have made Universal a shit ton of money with, they were the primary company involved in Jurassic World and in Straight Outta Compton.
Yeah, that was good.
And I'm not talking about quality. I'm just saying
money.
These are the beats. Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of things you can speculate on about these stories, but I don't know what the exact I don't know the exact things, but you can kind of see that there is something a little wobbly about where they've been in the last several years.
Right, and they wouldn't be moving around like they are if everything was fine.
They need a home base.
Yeah.
They'll probably just end up at Disney.
Probably. Okay, my first story. Michael Fassbender is set to star in Joe Nesbo's, I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right, The Snowman. No, it is not a reboot of the Jack Frost movie with Michael Keaton.
That's what I first thought. That wasn't just me. That's good.
No, it's based on a series of crime novels out of Sweden. And Swedish director Tomas Alfredson, who did Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy and Let the Right One In, the vampire movie, is going to be directing this.
Both good. I prefer vampires over, you know, British people talking quietly to each other. But either way, they're both pretty decent, at least.
Yeah, they're especially stylistically.
Well, I mean, in quality wise, they were.
Yeah,
good.
They're both.
I just
very...
was more drawn towards vampire children.
Right. Well, but they're both very icy. They're both very elusive. He's super into atmosphere. And
is it very cold movies too?
Yeah. Well, I mean,
can you see your breath while you're watching them.
That is the Swedish way.
Well, I was making snowman jokes because of the name.
Well, yeah, possibly that as well. And I think you know, people, you said that people have compared this guy as like the next Stieg Larsson.
Specifically the writer, not the director.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The writer of the book. They kind of look at him in a similar way. From what I remember of the synopsis of the book, it's about it's almost like a Stephen King, it's set in a small town.
Mm-hmm.
And the guy in this very small town, like, it's been 20 years of quiet, and then then they find this like family that's been murdered, and they realize that this might be the work of a serial killer in this quiet town. 20 years of peaceful, interrupted beauty, and now there's a serial killer. Yeah,
yeah. Again, sounds very Swedish, and very noir.
They like to kill people up there.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. It's actually like Sweden. I don't know a ton about it because I've never been there, but it's. In reality, it's actually one of those relatively safe places, like kind of like Norway and a lot of those other Scandinavian areas. They're like super socialist, so like everything is like, you know.
Well, specifically, they like
classes is working better than almost everywhere else in the world, and it's generally peaceful and people kind of get along. But then there's always where in any area like that in the world, or even in the United States, there's always that dark underpinning, that kind of like, I guess, like Lynchian thing, like that blue velvet kind of thing where it looks really, everything seems perfect, but in reality, there's something weird going on. Like in Norway, it's like bright and happy and skiing, but then that's also the mecca of black metal and people burning down churches.
Well, their art is, you know.
Yeah,
that's what I was specifically saying. I wasn't talking about the place itself, but rather the rather the art that comes out of there usually tends to be a little gloomy, or at least I guess the movies. I don't know. I haven't read a whole lot of books besides the Stieg Larsson ones.
Well, yeah, and well, this guy as well. So
I haven't read this.
I'm into this idea, and I can, you know, you think I'd be bored of Fassbender by now because he's damn near overused.
No,
but he's so good.
Yeah, exactly. Why would you get bored of that? I mean, if he was bad, but I'm really excited for Macbeth. That's another tangent, but we'll move on to our next news article.
Okay.
From Key and Peele, Jordan Peele will be directing a horror film called Get Out for Blumhouse. Now, Blumhouse is the small company that does cheap, they do cheap but pretty good productions. They've done like The Conjuring and The Paranormal Activity and Purge and whatever.
The Visit.
They've got The Visit. Oh, they did. That's ironic. But they tend to put out at least a decent product now and then. And I do like their model specifically. Like, we don't have to have the biggest budget. It's more about making a good film. But they right now are looking toward Jordan Peele to make a more racially driven horror thriller. Specifically, this is what he says. People know me for my work in comedy, but now I'll get to focus on my passion for writing and directing horror films. Like comedy, horror has an ability to provoke thought and further the conversation on real social issues in a very powerful way. Get Out takes on the task of exploring race in America somewhat that hasn't really been done within the genre for the last genre since Night of the Living Dead Living Dead 47 years ago. There should have been a comma there. It's a long overdue. I think if you think about some of their more production heavy
sketches
that have to do with race, like I specifically think of the zombie one. Have you seen the racist zombie one?
Yeah.
I think he probably does have a knack for this, and I would be extremely into him doing a film like this. So, I'm down.
It's also funny, like, I mean, I love Key and Peele. Their sketches, I think, are just, like, the sharpest being written today. And, unfortunately, it's their last season, and, you know, which makes sense why he's looking towards other projects now.
Apparently, they're making a movie right before another. There's a movie right before this that they're doing. I
kind of know about that. Yeah, that's a comedy. Right. But yeah, it's if you look at their sketches, Jordan Peele often likes to play kind of like back in the SNL days of Dan Aykroyd. He likes to play weirdo loners a lot. Like, it's
sure, you
know, he has a couple different archetypes, and he is really into playing, like, he'll kind of go super dark. If I'm judging on based on who gets to be more of the character in the sketch and who's the straight man, he usually is playing the character.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of sketches where it starts out funny enough, and then it'll just get to a point of just being really weird or dark. What comes to mind is the one where him and Key are on the road, and he puts on his MP3 player, and then all of a sudden they pick up an audio diary.
Yeah.
Of all these weird experiments he's doing to himself.
I find those really funny, but again, imagine that horror stuff.
Apparently. Right. Comedy and horror are so intertwined.
They're very similar. And
they both work on timing. They both work on expectations, and, you know, comedy comes from tragedy anyways. It's sort of an acknowledging of it.
Well, yeah, I always like characters in comedy that are like the ones where they're like the nicest person, but everybody hates them.
Yeah.
Like the Jerry and like Parks and Rec and stuff like that.
Sure.
I've seen that type come up a lot over the last few years, but I still enjoy it every time.
So I guess the question is, can we take him seriously as a, you know, well, depending on what the tone of whatever it is he's going to be. I don't think it's going to, we have to worry about it becoming like a Scary Movie 5 kind of situation, or like a Haunted House situation, because his references are on point.
I think specifically, I mean, he also said he's making a horror thriller. Didn't say horror comedy. He didn't say anything like that. So yeah, I actually expect this to, I think this is be pretty cool, and I'm gonna keep my eye out for it. So
definitely.
Most deaf.
I was trying something new.
Yeah, that sometimes works well. Okay. That was not one of those cases. Let's go.
Yeah. Let's go ahead and move on to the pet topic. You said you had one. And we won't spend a ton of time on it, but let's see what you got.
Okay. So something I've been thinking about a lot, and this might be end up being something we might have to return to, because I don't know if I don't have a good answer for it. I really don't. But I thought I'd kind of put it past you and see what you think. So with all the different mediums there are, I kind of wanted to start kind of dissecting them, mm-hmm. and kind of like what makes them different, and what specifically, what are the strengths of all the different mediums? So I'm talking about like what's the difference between film and TV, what's the difference between TV and comics, comics and movies, poetry and comics, blah, blah, blah.
You're talking specifically with how each medium deals with narrative.
Sure.
Not the inherent differences of a visual medium versus a non-visual medium.
Well, I mean, that's the first place I went to is form. I mean, that's the obvious place. But I guess I more do want to be kind of like, what is the key essential? What sets them apart in narrative?
Right.
And I think you have to start with form no matter what, though.
Well, yeah, the form is clearly the issue, the subject. Mm-hmm. And that is sort of what changes things. But it's also about how people approach the form. Sure. Both the people who are creating and the people who are engaging. And I think that there's different expectations. Like, you know, we've talked a lot about on this podcast as well as on our own. We've talked a lot about how there's biases towards comic books because it's seen as a children's medium still in some circles, or like a fanboy medium or whatever, and people don't take it seriously. But we know, because we're kind of in it, that people can tell very, very serious stories in comic books that people wouldn't even know are being written for it.
It's just a medium.
Right.
I feel like I've a broken record this episode, but being a big horror guy, this last week I read a book called My Friend Dahmer. It's a little slice of life comic, really, but it's probably one of the creepiest things I've ever read. I've been paranoid the last couple of weeks because of this book.
That's good to know.
So you should read it right away.
It sounds interesting. Yeah. If you look at like something like that, or I mean, I guess the best way to kind of research this, if you're really looking for like how does a story change, mm-hmm. is you can find a story that's being the same story that's being told in multiple mediums.
That's true. That's one.
So, I mean, I don't know. What's something that spans across the most mediums? Beowulf?
Maybe.
Or something to that degree, something like that.
I guess you could, yeah, I mean, you could also go to, like, Shakespeare references and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Maybe Game of Thrones, but it hasn't been made into a movie.
Or a comic book, has it?
Yeah, it's been made into a comic book. I mean, they're kind of crappy because it's a bad adaptation, but...
Yeah.
I mean, that's the hard thing, is finding something that's hit all of these mediums, really.
Right.
But to me, it more gets into what's special about them and what makes each one tick a little bit more. Because that's why I went specifically to form first, is because when you're looking at, like, let's just go to movies and comics.
Uh-huh.
Now, there is a lot of crossover, and, I mean, even academically, they want to talk about them.
In tandem.
They want to talk about how similar comics are, but I think the kind of the way that they compare it falls through at a point, and then they kind of don't know what they don't know how to fill in that gap.
Yeah.
Specifically, I think because it's a static image versus a moving image, that's where you're going to get thrown off. And also, there's still a very important, even though I think the art is a more important part of comics, the actual written word is still, like, I find Nuff Said or comics that don't have any words on them to often be boring. So I think it has as much to do with film as it does something like poetry. There's a specific space meant for the words, and you have to be very pithy, and you have to be able to put them in a specific place to really narrate the point you're trying to get across.
Right. You have to think in terms of a storytelling economy.
Well, storytelling economy as well as, because you can get a lot through the images, but specifically with the writing, you have to really be on the nose of what it is. Like, it was funny because it almost like it's important to be there, but it's almost a placeholder to move along your pacing at the right speed, if that makes sense.
Yeah. No, I would generally agree with that. I think that I don't know, if you compare something like a novel to a movie, and you know, a lot of movies are made from novels. We just talked about a couple that are going to be made from a novel into a film, and then, you know, there's always that, like, people are generally disappointed with the adaptations. Even if it ends up being like a huge smash hit, like something like Harry Potter or The Hunger Games or Girl with the Dragon Tattoo or whatever, there's always something that's lost in translation when you change mediums.
There's a large contingent of people that won't be satisfied because, yeah, I mean, if we're talking about that specifically, it mostly comes to point of view.
That's what I was going to say. I think what changes a lot from a novel, where you're allowed to kind of explore in a novel, that's harder to do in a film, because a film, you kind of have to get in and out, even if it's a long film, like 3 hours. And you know, generally don't want to go over that. Generally don't want to go over 2 hours, but if you indulge to three, even then it's really hard to fully develop the entire mind space of a character like you can in a book. Cause you can spend an entire chapter or two, or off and on as the book goes, on just stopping the action and like getting into the mind of a character and just exploring where they are emotionally.
And I think movies are better at focusing on maybe a singular character. I think it has to be a little bit more myopic because of its size.
Mm-hmm.
And also, unless you're doing like Eternal Monologue, which can kind of take you out of the film, I think sometimes. I partially disagree.
There's no hard and fast rules for anything. But what
I'm saying is in general, what a book does a lot better is to get you into that mind space and to get you into that specific, into that person's point of view. And I think it's probably the most successful of any of the mediums for doing that. I think it really puts you in perspective of somebody.
Right. A book in general is better at being interior.
Yeah.
And it's really difficult for a film to be interior because it's a visual medium and you have to move along so quickly in your storytelling that it's really difficult to live a character's live through a character internally. I mean, some films have approached that very, very well.
See, just thinking about it, the first thing that came to mind was Earl Morris, not like a normal.
The documentarian.
Yeah, the documentarian. Not a normal, like, narrative kind of piece, but actually somebody who's going out there and kind of showing you the social surroundings.
Right. So, he investigates things very thoroughly. And some of his stuff is more, I mean, you know, he's done things like Thin Red Line or like the...
Thin Blue Line.
Thin Blue Line, you're right. Or he's done things like, what was that? What was that one about the crazy lady who cloned her dog?
Tabloid.
That's a great one. But those ones are a little bit more pulled back and a little bit more big picture. Whereas if you look at something like Cheap, Fast, and Out of Control, that one's extremely interior and it's all kind of metaphorical. Like it's the subject isn't really what he's talking about.
Sure.
I think, you know, art film in particular has been able to explore mood and personality and character a little bit more internally than typical mainstream narrative film.
I think you're right, but I still think a book, just even your run-of-the-mill pulp novel can do it more so than your even your deepest, most intellectual movie. I think a movie can do better than a book is play with mood through aesthetic.
Right.
And play through it, lighting and how actual physical surroundings and settings can really mess with us as a human.
Mise-en-scene, yes.
Yes, exactly.
Not to get all film school.
No, it's okay. Please do. You are artsy fartsy and film schooly, Cassidy. That's like half of the part of this podcast.
Right.
You should do that.
And what I was going to say is like, even though like, you know, an art film might be able to really explore the internal mood of a character or his constitution, you know, whatever, there's always a deficit because then you're kind of giving up narrative and in being able to do so. And some directors I think are very good at like balancing the two.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, that's sort of that, like that perfect hum, that perfect harmony when you can get just close enough at keeping both engines going at the same time. That's when, you know, that's when you transcend a good movie to a great film.
Well, see, then this is where my next kind of question comes in, because we all often, I don't know if there's that much of a difference, but they're looked at as a very different thing.
Mm-hmm.
Medium is TV versus film.
Well, a TV in a way, I think is able to work a lot more like a novel, because you can work on a season basically like you would an entire book. Like if you take like a season of Mad Men, let's say, you know, not every single episode has to be about plot.
Yeah, it's episodic.
Exactly. Yeah, and not, well, I mean, even episodic television previously, you know, if you're looking at like your CSIs or your I don't know, what's some of those procedural
Law and Order.
Law and Order, that kind of thing. That's just kind of rinse and repeat every episode. There's a new crime, a new investigation, they solve it by the end, blah, blah, blah. And then, you know, people like that consistency, but you know, if you look at something a little bit more...
People like that people are constantly murdered every night on TV.
Yeah, it's her favorite thing. But if you look at like stuff like Mad Men or like, I guess this new age, the new golden age of television or whatever, Breaking Bad and you know, these different kinds of shows, True Detective, blah, blah, blah. They're able to kind of work a little bit more novelistically where they can kind of set out a season, sort of build an arc, and then each explore different things with the characters episode per episode. And you know, something can kind of go off the arc and more into an interior space or more into something like that. So in a lot of ways, there's television and novels, you know, television at its best, not like Naked Dating or Shark Tank or something like that. But
right.
Television at its best, narrative television, can be a lot more closer to a novel than a film can.
Well, maybe that's why something like Game of Thrones is adapted more, is adapted better through TV than it would be through a film, because of the breadth of just like how much is going on and how many characters there are and stuff. You just wouldn't have that time to develop that in a movie. And it would lose its flavor and what the essence of that, why Game of Thrones is interesting.
Right. I mean, you do. I think you still do lose. I don't want to like say that it's a straight crossover, but I think you do lose something in like the poetry of prose, something about the style in which somebody writes or the way a writer kind of describes a scene or, you know, sets up a scene or writes dialogue or whatever.
Well, I mean, even the TV show, I mean, talking about that one specifically too, that specifically TV platform, they've even when they kind of just have to tweak something a little for the TV show because it wouldn't make sense because the book is a little, has something that's more inner than outer and you can't show it.
Yeah.
They have to tweak it a little bit, and that has led to the, you know, these last seasons being in some cases completely different. Also budgetary restraints. You don't have a budget in comics or books or any of those things. Whereas it does heavily influence things like movies and TV.
Yeah,
you just can't put 50 dragons on the screen.
No, I mean, yeah, you can write 50 dragons very easily.
Yes.
You know, all it takes to write something and you can the budget is in your brain, you know, it's just a pen and piece of paper and you get to go wild. But as soon as you, yeah, whenever you put a production behind something, whether it's a movie or a play or whatever, you know, then you have a whole army trying to tell one story. And
well, even getting back to comics a little bit, one of my bigger mistakes when I've been doing them is at first I would write something that had too many, like it would even just have like two police officers instead of one police officer, because that just seems more normal to me. But just by doing that, you're filling up your little panel with too much information. There's only so much. And so sometimes it just comes to the actual, what the physicality of the thing is. So in comics, you only have so much space in panels and on the page.
Going back to the idea of the economy of storytelling, and each medium has a different economy. Like in a novel, you are given a lot more space and breadth to describe something and go into something than you do in a film, and probably even less so in a comic.
About 80 to 100,000 words.
Right.
Yes.
All right. We got to move on.
Yep.
I think we solved that. We figured that all completely out.
I don't think
out.
We did. I think
it's set in stone.
It's not set in stone.
It is
now
law, what we just said.
We. I wish. No, specifically I wanted to kind of more like, is there anybody out there that has some thoughts on this? Because I think that this is maybe, this isn't something that just we could solve, and it's something that could be talked to death. So if there's anybody else out there that has anything to add, please send something in about this.
Yeah.
I am actually very curious, and I don't have all the answers to this. I'm still trying to.
If you have an opinion about this, go ahead and email us at jabberinthedrone@gmail.com. And we'll read it on air. Okay, let's go ahead and move on to our main review of the week, which is M. Night Shyamalan's The Visit.
Are you being funny, or is that how you're supposed to say it?
I've heard it various different ways. That's one of the ways I've heard it. I'm just kind of reading out phonetically. But, okay, so, yeah, this is the new M. Night Shyamalan film, and I wrote my review, actually, for this already, because we took a week off. You know, it seemed like sort of the easy way to go, but I had to basically frame the review with M. Night Shyamalan has a reputation that precedes him, whether he wants it or not.
Sure.
And, you know, he's had a very interesting arc as a director. Started out as kind of the golden child. You know, he made one smaller film that most people didn't see. And I've already forgot what it was called. It was a comedy. It had Rosie O'Donnell in it.
Okay, sure.
Came out like the mid-90s. But then like his second film, which was the Sixth Sense, was nominated for Best Picture and, you know, acting nominations, writing nominations, and really put supernatural horror in the light in a big way, and in the mainstream in a big way that I hadn't really seen since, I don't know, The Poltergeist.
Well, what's weird about you just saying that too, because there was a big interim with slashers, I guess. Yeah. This could be almost, the Sixth Sense could be almost like a front runner for all these Paranormal Activity and all that kind of bullshit.
Sure, definitely. I think that was a big return to sort of the ghosty thing, and it was done in this kind of, you know, sincere and tender and kind of complex way. It wasn't just done as like a low budget cheap horror film. So anyways, fast forward into the future. He has a few hits and a lot of misses. And ever since Lady in the Water, which I contend is probably still his worst film, he's been stumbling from one bad mistake into another, and he now doesn't have that big budget to make that big prestige film anymore. So now he's teamed up with Blumhouse Productions, which we talked about before, is kind of well known for having modestly budgeted horror movies that have big returns, because, you know, they're really well marketed. And he's kind of scaling it back. This is a found footage film. Although if you look at the movie, he still finds ways of cheating and being able to kind of set up shots and stuff that you would normally not see in a found footage film.
Mm-hmm.
But the basic story is there's two kids, teenagers, named Becca and Tyler, and their single mother is sending them off to go visit their grandparents for the first time. She sort of is estranged from her parents. She hasn't talked to them for a really long time. So these kids have never met their grandparents before, and but she wants them to have a relationship regardless. So she sends them off on a train, and they kind of go off into the Midwest, sort of in the middle of nowhere, this farmhouse that she grew up in as a kid, and they meet Nana and Papa for the first time, and at first they seem, you know, eccentric, but fairly normal for a weird old people. There's obviously kind of like an age gap kind of thing going on. The girl who's filming this whole thing as a documentary, that's the conceit that Shyamalan comes up with for why we're seeing this. She wants to do a documentary about reconciliation between her mother and her grandparents while also like trying to get to know them. Ed Oxenbould, who plays Tyler, is kind of more just there along for the ride. He's a aspiring hip-hop artist. And gives us a few of his rap stylings as the movie goes. And after a couple days, they realize that Nana and Papa aren't so normal. The grandma is up in the middle of the night scratching on the walls nude. Grandpa is going off into the woods and taking weird trips to a shed without telling people why. Playing with his gun in weird ways. And it kind of starts to become more and more of a traditional horror film as the movie goes on.
Well, I think
that's all I had for the synopsis, but...
Yeah. Go for it.
Oh, you go for it. You sound like you had an in there.
Well, I did. And the thing is I think that this is... as a horror, I think that it's okay. I'm not a big M. Night Shyamalan fan.
Period. Okay.
I've been hit or miss with his different ones. Some of them I actually kind of liked Unbreakable.
And yeah, that's sort of his Jackie Brown, I think. Like a lot of people who, it's the M. Night Shyamalan film for people who don't like M. Night Shyamalan films.
Maybe that's why I like it. I didn't know if it had a reputation for that. That's funny. Essentially, I've never been crazy about his surprise, because it's not a surprise. It's where everybody tells you it's a surprise.
Uh-huh.
And if you do it every time, it's not a surprise anymore.
Right.
Now, this movie itself is a mixed bag. I found the kids really obnoxious most of the time, and I didn't find... I didn't find either of them to be realistic children. Some of the things that the Olivia DeJonge character was talking about with film, I was just like, okay, whatever. Maybe when you're 20, you'd be talking like that. But,
right. Going back into discussion of mise-en-scene.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then him talking about some of his stuff, I was like, okay, maybe you're daydreaming about a rapper, but maybe you're not actually making little rhymes. I think he was supposed to be endearing, but I just found him super obnoxious.
Right.
But beyond that, I found the grandparents and their performances very... They worked. I thought that they were pretty creepy, and they was very subtle and came across a little bit by little bit. The actual narrative, at first, I was kind of annoyed by the conceit. But then, as time went on, I actually kind of gave into it and kind of enjoyed it.
Okay.
So... I have mixed feelings on it. As for a M. Night Shyamalan, if I'm judging him just as what he does, yeah. I think I enjoyed it more than most of his films I've seen.
Oh, wow.
Including some of the ones I know you like Signs, I think is the one.
Signs is fine. I don't think that it's his best movie, but I think it was before the worst of it.
Maybe I was thinking of something else. I just never found that film very compelling. I guess when they, 20-year-old spoiler alert, as soon as they revealed the reveal, I was like, this is retarded. This is dumb. Do not, no, don't even. This film, I don't know. This film, I feel like is a little more subtle than some of the other ones he's done. And I just feel like he's where he's supposed to be. trying to make prestige films out of horror. I feel like he should just be making regular horror, but I feel like he's been so long out of that field that he's forgotten what he is, And so he tries to make these weird characters that don't completely work on the screen, but then, I don't know. It's a mixed bag. I do feel like his little reveals of how weird they are and kind of the unwrapping of it did work. I wasn't that scared, but at the same time, I think that it kind of worked as a narrative. I know other people in the audience were reacting a lot more than I was. I was like, oh, that's a thing? Oh, okay, cool. But
it was really strange seeing the reaction to this. Where did I see this? I think I saw this. Oh, I saw this at the Landmark over at the Clueless Mall. There was a decent amount of people there, not a lot, but there was probably maybe 20 or so in the theater with me. And it was a really strange kind of reaction from the theater, because I felt like there was a lot of times when there's some jump scares or whatever, you know, Jack in the Box scares that kind of got everybody, and some jolts or whatever. There's a lot of stuff in here that I think was intentionally funny that people laughed at. And I think there's a lot of stuff in this movie that was not intentionally funny that people laughed at.
Yeah.
Great. This movie was a chore for me.
Okay.
I did not enjoy much of it. I will say that there's things about it that work, but I think they are vastly outweighed by the things that don't work. These children, I can't. I feel like they're so loaded with affectation.
Yeah.
All the characters, really, but them in the worst of ways. You know, the film school, like, artsy, whatever, like, I didn't buy it for a second. I hate it when you watch child actors who, you know, they don't understand their dialogue.
Well, beyond
they're
that,
they're saying
too,
things that they have no idea what they're talking about.
To me, it felt lectury, too.
And it felt more like M. Night Shyamalan informing this character with knowledge he has that has nothing to do with the movie. Also, like I said before, I felt like it was his way of cheating and saying, I can make the scene look a little nice and I can have some.
Well, that's what I'm talking about, the lecturing. Whenever she would talk, right. I felt like he was trying to talk to other people who have made these kind of like films. But I feel like some of the other people that have made these handheld camera like horror films have done better. So I was just kind of like, okay, whatever, dude. That was...
Well, and it also seems formally inconsistent because of that. Like, there's some scenes where he clearly setting the camera in a place so that he can have, like, a very distinct framing. And then there's some scenes where it's not doing that at all. And it to me, it's just like everything else in the movie, is totally confused. I think this movie is a tonal disaster. I think that it is jumping all over the place. Part of the movie wants to be this kind of...
I wouldn't have felt like that if it didn't end the way it did.
Well,
it ends on a very specifically denouement that is horrible.
It ends three times, and each time is three different movies that's constantly fighting through this movie. And part of it wants to be like this really sincere, heartwarming, kind of almost like The Sixth Sense in a way, where people like come together and they learn something and blah, blah, blah. His like Spielbergian influence that he's, you know, one of his clearest influences he's always carried. And then he has this kind of perverse and twisted horror film. And towards the end of the movie, by the last third of the movie, when the rubber really hits the road, I think that's the stuff that works the best. When it kind of gets really, really twisted and sick and kind of like nihilistically funny.
Well, that's why I think I enjoyed it more than you, is because my laziest film goer inside of me was entertained by that.
But here's the thing, even though
I don't disagree with any of your points so far. You are completely knocking it. You know, you're hitting the nail. The hammer is hitting the nail perfectly.
Good.
I don't think you're off. I'm just saying those parts entertained my bad moviegoer.
Right. No, yeah. it eventually gets to it. But when I saw that movie that it could be, when he really just kind of lets go and lets crazy, that's when I was like, that's what this movie should have been the whole time. In a way, this is almost like his Red State.
Oh, okay. And see, I disagree with, but that's for that. That's neither here nor there.
Well, what I mean by that is that I think there's an anger in this film that has to do with the perception of his career. And there's a lot of stuff where he's trying to burn an effigy of M. Night Shyamalan. You know, that's why he doesn't go for the big budget. That's why he doesn't have the long, ponderous scenes with, you know, still camera work and like really quietly whispered dialogue. All the stuff that he's kind of known for, he tries to sort of whittle away. But at the same time, he always comes back to the things he's struggles with the most, one of which being exposition. He is one of the worst directors and writers when it comes to exposition. And here he's like, well, it's a documentary, so people can just turn to the camera and explain everything they're feeling and everything that they, you know, and explain all their motivations. And we can leave nothing to the imagination. To me, there is nothing in this movie that is subtle. Even Nana and Papa should call out the actors, Deanna Dunnigan and Peter McRobey, who I think are totally committed to their wacky ass performances.
That's what I'm saying is I'm saying that their performances are done well. Yeah. Not necessarily in their characters are done well. Yes.
Yes. In spite of the movie, I think they kind of get how campy this is and they really sort of embrace it, and good for them. They come off the best in this movie. I could not care if these children lived or died. In fact, I wanted them to die very early on in the movie. Ed Oxenbold has this, I called it in my review, I said he has this bright-eyed audition face there's nothing about him that is likable in the slightest. I know he was in the so-and-so's Very Bad Day children's movie. I didn't see that, so I don't know if he comes off better when he's not working with this kind of material. But I don't know. To me, this whole movie, like, he has this, like, stupid, again, another one of these stupid affectations thing where he, like, decides in the middle of the movie that he's going to start saying pop stars' names instead of swear words. And
just, that was dumb. I hated that.
Every character choice that he writes for these kids is just bad. I actually think that the girl, Olivia DeLange, is maybe a good actor, but she's buried behind these ridiculous affectations that he writes.
I'm trying to think of, she reminds me of an actress that's decent. I can't think of where.
She has some moments where she's not directly saying her character's subtext to the camera, where she actually kind of comes off as believable. But, I can't abide by this movie. And I know that some people are saying this is the return to form and here's the Shyamalan that, you know, doing what he should be doing. And I just think he might be too far gone.
I just don't I think those other two movies that you're talking about, because the denouement on this is, I actually thought one of the worst parts. It when really you, pissed me off.
When you find out what's going on.
No. When the film is actually ending and it starts to go into the three different sections. I'd already touched on it a little bit, but there's the warm and sappy one that he introduces halfway through.
Yeah.
And I think that whole byline can just be cut. I think
it needed to be there a little, but it didn't need to be there at the end. Actually,
I don't think so. I don't think it needed to be there.
I felt like if the movie had ended the first time, it would have been a little abrupt, but it would have been in keeping with how crazy everything got. And it actually felt like, I thought it kind of was going to end on a pretty decent note, and then I maybe would have bumped it up like half a grade or something. But
I completely agree, and it would have for me too, because I liked that cold ending. I was like, oh, that's
exactly
cool.
Like, let's,
it's dark and mean. I like that.
Exactly. It would have been like his little red state ending. And then, but then he can't control himself, and he has to go back to, well, how are, you know, let's wrap everything up with the emotional story, which never really works anyway. And then, in case you're not annoyed, let's have some more comedy wrapping at the end.
That the kid really pissed you off, didn't he? That's what I'm getting from your review the most.
He is almost Jake Lloyd bad. Almost, not quite.
Sure. No, I don't think you're wrong. I don't think anything you're saying wrong. I guess the part that I tapped into was the creepy grandparents, crazy stuff, mean stuff that happened. I did kind of enjoy that. I don't think that there was... Was it a B movie? Hell yes, it was a B movie. Did I like it for being a grandparents horror film?
Sort of.
I liked that part.
He sort of embraces the B movie camp of it, or somebody's embracing it. I'm not sure if it's him or his editors or the actors, but every once in a while, it
maybe
it
a little bit
of
of all three.
It kind of finds the tone that it should be, and it's and you know there's sort of like a Hansel and Gretel kind of fairy tale thing going on in here too, which is sort of neat.
Well, if he would have just done that, I can see what you're saying. I think it would have been a lot better. But I just kind of, I don't know, I'm not even saying like I'd go back to it necessarily, but when I was sitting there, I was like, oh, yeah, I can relate. Old people are creepy.
Well, and also, yeah, the you know, as far as like the horror movie idea of like you take something, a natural paranoia that everybody has and then augment it, you know, the idea of, and I haven't seen a lot of horror movies do this, and it's kind of clever, you know, taking the paranoia that people have, especially young people, about growing older and losing your physical and mental capabilities, you know, that's a real paranoia. People are squeamish around old people. Some
it's
people
kind of
more
a type
than
of
others.
Like, it's kind of a type of body horror, kind
yeah,
of.
Yeah, and it's one that I think not a lot of people has tapped into before because it's sort of insensitive. But that's what the movie should have been, is insensitive. The movie works best when it's mean and it and angry and he has something to prove. When he tries to go back to his, like, you know, Spielbergian sentimentality or his comedy, which he just is so tone deaf. It's unbelievable.
Where he was making a like a B or a C version of an Amblin movie. Yeah.
Yeah. Then it just falls the fuck apart.
I don't have a lot to say about this, but I think that what you're saying makes sense. So, yeah. Yes. Yes, Cassidy. I'm validating you here on the podcast. It doesn't happen often, but I'm giving you this. Accept it.
This movie kind of made me angry.
Good.
It was more than just like, you know, a casual eh. It was like, fuck this movie, especially by the end. Anyway.
Well, I'm glad we could exercise your feelings like here on the podcast.
And I'm not just here to rant because, you know, it's funny to hear like an angry critic or whatever. I read an article of somebody, a defender of this movie, saying like, you know, there's people who are just out to, you know, with pitchforks and torches to, like, because they're out for blood and they want to make fun of M. Night Shyamalan because he's an easy target. No, I generally, every time I walk into an M. Night Shyamalan movie, I should know better by now, but every time I walk into one of his movies, I always hope for the best because I remember at a point in time when he was a good filmmaker.
You kind of liked him for a while.
For a while, I was a defender of The Village.
Mm-hmm.
And then when Lady in the Water happened, there was nothing I could defend there. And ever since, it's been, you know, he's somehow gotten worse and worse.
Well, you're still defending a part of this movie. You're just not the bulk of it.
I think there's an inherent talent there that is that he can't occasionally have bright moments.
He needs somebody to be like, bring this in. Like,
you would think Blumhouse would be that, and in a way it is, but there's still just failings as a storyteller he has that he cannot get past. And the fact that everyone's, you know, it has like a 60-something% on Rotten Tomato, which is just enough to make it fresh, he's going to learn the wrong lessons from this. So instead, we're just going to get bad B-movie M. Night Shyamalan.
Maybe not. I think this is a better step than where he is going. This might piss you off, the movie, but I think that it's a step in the right, like, I don't have to make these big, huge, whatever, whispery baloney movies. I think it's a good step. I don't disagree with any of your criticisms. And yes, the character named Tyler, played by Ed Oxenbold, is obnoxious and terrible, absolutely terrible. And I don't feel like I'm being just hyperbolizing either. He was the worst part of that movie by far.
Mm-hmm. I can't imagine anyone watch that and
no, if you can't, that's what I was really getting at, is if you could really not see that he was obnoxious and stuff like that, then you're an obnoxious person is probably what's happening.
That's what's
he's just fine. My rap career is going great.
All right, let's go ahead and get onto the Netflix homework. Which I assigned to you a couple weeks ago.
This was a crazy grab bag pick.
I sort of knew what it was. I'd seen a trailer for this at an art house a long time ago.
No. This is a good crazy bag. Like, it's one of those ones where you can kind of see, like, the front and the back, what might be in there, but you don't really know what's in the middle.
Mm.
So, and it was that. I'll kind of try to explain the movie.
Okay.
So a 13-year-old girl, basically, she's sent to live with her dad, and she has this dog. And basically, the dog is, you know, he's kind of beaten up and sent on a journey in life and ends up in all sorts of weird episodic adventures where he is a dog fighter and all sorts of things, setting dogs loose in the city.
He's captured at one point. He's captured and put in the pound.
Okay, this movie is strange to me. Well, okay, it is an art movie. I will give them that. But at the same time, this is a B movie. I don't give a shit what they're telling me, like, through whatever else. At the same time, I'm like, you're making a B movie.
Yeah.
This is about dogs attacking a city, really, at the end. Now, is there other interesting things? Yeah, there's this wonderful daughter and father kind of interaction that goes on throughout, because there's this kind of strained relationship that's been kind of broken throughout a divorce. And so the father is trying to kind of be better, but he kind of sees her as a little girl still, and she's kind of growing up and having like older girl problems. It's kind of weird, though, because she's like, it's always interesting to see other countries' versions, because I feel like they're more realistic with children. Like, she's having like actual like what kind of a conversation. She's not talking just about toys, even though she's like 14.
Right.
They don't infantilize her just because she's a young person.
No, yeah. So she's interested in a boy that's in her like music class, and you know, there's a scene where she's like trying to impress him, and almost in a weird way, in a less kind of darkly comic way, but in a weird way, it kind of reminded me of Welcome to the Dollhouse at points, where she's embarrassingly trying to be sexy and not pulling it off.
Okay, I don't know that reference, but go. But yeah, it has all of these subtle like character moments mixed with this weird, this like if you took Homeward Bound, but you made a really dark, messed up, gritty version of it. That was what the other movie was with this dog.
It was like Homeward Bound meets The Birds.
Meets the what?
The Birds.
The Birds a little bit, but I was thinking like even like a crime movie. Like if you took like this is going to come up again. I think it's just because you brought it up the last week, but like Harry Brown.
Yeah.
You took all of those and put it in a blender. That's exactly what this other movie would be. And it's sort of interesting because it makes you think like, I mean, I try to read into the movie a little bit because I especially with a film that comes from a different country, they're actually trying to put in other content and actually kind of a message. And I was trying to try it and decide if this dog was kind of a like a metaphor for the girl getting into like trouble, or maybe it was like maybe the dog was a metaphor for another person or girl who got it mixed up into like, you know, like human trafficking or something like that. I don't know if that's true or just in the system in general. But then comes back to, you know, bite the hand that feeds.
Literally.
Yeah, literally. But you know what? I was really entertained by the B-moviness of the dog attack stuff.
Mm-hmm.
The army forming up and trying to, I don't know, it was like the dog.
You know, it kind of reminded me of a little bit narratively in structure and sort of in the way that it plays out. It reminded me a decent amount of Rise of the Planet of the Apes.
No, definitely. For sure.
You even have like a Caesar-like character.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, that's what this...
Hagen, the dog, the main dog of the movie.
Hagen. yes, the dog.
This is a Hungarian film. I enjoyed the hell out of this movie.
I did too, but I have some like little, not necessarily marks against it, but at the same time, I find it strange because I'm like, I don't think that this is necessarily as serious as a film as it's trying to be.
I don't think it's trying to be. I think it's funny because Hungary submitted this as their Academy Award contender.
Yeah.
But I think the director is very aware of its B-movie influences, especially towards the end. I don't think you would have these attack scenes, the way they're filmed and the way it's shot, And the music, the bombastic kind of orchestra music that's playing in the background, it knows exactly what it's being. And I think it's having a lot of fun with that. And I think it's a maybe a foreign film thing, but I've noticed this a little bit, where in like European films or whatever, they can do genre films, or even something like a Pedro Almodovar film, like The Skin I Live In.
Oh my gosh.
Yes. They can do a genre thing, but they don't have to divorce the art in order to embrace genre. They can do both.
And yeah, no, that is liberating. But I don't know. Sometimes I know that he's going for something and I can feel that. But I mean, take Let the Right One In. I think that that's arty and does genre. The vampire and genre thing. I don't feel like this always mixes it in a perfect combination. But I don't dislike the... I don't dislike the weird tonal things. Yeah, I just find them sometimes a little a little bit too much of it at an angle for to be a good juxtaposition.
I would say this. I think that there's a point in the movie when there's the A plot and the B plot. And I would say that the dog is the A plot. He's the character I'm the most invested in. And actually, you know, there's long stretches of this movie when it's just him where... you know, this is a great film, I would say, to show in film school, specifically for like aspiring directors and cameramen, to show how you can portray perspective through the camera. Because they really, you know, they show like all of the stuff through the dog's perspective, not only just by lowering the camera to dog point of view, but also by like if the dog is nervous, what does it mean to shoot something in a nervous way? Or whatever, or if a dog is overly trusting, what does it mean to show that visually through the dog's perspective? And I think there's a lot of like silent film stuff in this movie. I said the same thing with Rise of the Planet of the Apes. When you can tell a story through the camera, that's good filmmaking. And this is good filmmaking in that way. My only knock on this is I think that towards the middle of the movie, when we're going back and forth for the A and B plot, there's a point in this movie where I'm not that interested in the girl anymore. And I think that we've said pretty much what we need to say with her, and eventually it has to come back to her. But I think there's a point in this movie when it should have been more dog, less girl.
Or maybe there's a better way to tie the two together. It may be more of a symbolic way or something like that. But no, the dog was primary
interest. Ending is very, very... perfect, I think. And I think it really like kind of comes together and pulls those two threads together in a very, very good way. But
the translation of the title, I've just got to say it real quick, is they should have figured something else out. It feels very...
You think White God is a little too...
It sounds very racist.
Well, here's the thing, and I mentioned this to you before last time. There was a film in the early 80s called White Dog.
Okay.
Which was about a dog that was trained by white supremacists to be racist. And so I kind of feel like I thought about that movie while I was watching this with the title. And there's a little bit of what maybe is, I'm not entirely sure, I don't entirely own this interpretation because it doesn't totally play out that way towards the end. But when he's like going through and he's like captured and being sold, it feels a little bit like maybe a slave allegory.
Well, that's what I was saying, like the human trafficking.
Yeah, and he's being beaten and trained.
Or even just part of the criminal. That's why I said system too, because like if you kind of look at, because I don't think the pound was necessarily that bad. They were just overworked and they had too much to do. And so it's just, it's a kid in the system. He was, you know, he wasn't actually, you know, maybe the metaphor wasn't he wasn't actually a dog, but that he was like just, you know, that stray kid that's left out on the street. There's the narrative of the father and the daughter where they're saying this is one possibility where the father and the daughter reconcile. And this is the other one where they become a runaway. And this is what these are the possibilities of what can happen and what their life could be. And making them more of a dog instead of a human kind of makes a separation that you don't have to necessarily be like, wow, this is some really heavy stuff. I'm tuning out a little.
Yeah.
I that's what I interpreted. And I think there's enough there to warrant that kind of interpretation. But I think narratively that it does maybe kind of drop it at from time to time.
I would say that I think more or less works, and I think that there's something about this movie that's so idiosyncratic, but also kind of in a way that I feel is very approachable.
Well, and I never knew I wanted an adult version of Homeward Bound until I watched this movie.
Right.
And then I was like, no, I really do. I really do want those Milo and Otis, but you know, there's a weird subtext
horror twist to it. Yeah. No, this is a strange film, and I think, but it's also very approachable, and I think very watchable. I think the movie isn't slow. It doesn't. It moves along nicely, and I think that the set pieces are beautifully shot.
Yeah. Did you feel about the dour like colors of everything?
It made sense. It's Eastern European.
I just feel
like that's what every movie I've ever seen that's sort of in that area tends to kind of look and feel like this. Actually, this is one of the peppier ones.
In a way, yes. I don't know. I felt like that they could have. I mean, maybe it's just because we watched other movies recently that kind of control colors and stuff like that a little bit more. Maybe kind of drop into the. Maybe kind of drop into those colors. Maybe not starting there.
Well, I think like the shots of like, or you know, if you want to like talk about like the difference, the separation of like class and stuff. I think there's you know, her and her like music school and like the concert scene and stuff like that. It's shot pretty differently, and you know, it definitely doesn't look as dour. And there's also the scene when she's like in the rave and stuff like that, gritty, but again, a little bit more flashy. So I don't think it's all just like urban squalor, but there is
no. It's a small nitpick. It's not a
right.
It's not an actual complaint. My actual feeling on the movie is I more or less just really kind of enjoyed it. It's strange, but I would recommend it to most people, especially if you're into like kind of weird foreign films. You kind of mentioned Pedro Almodovar.
Yeah.
And more or less I would recommend it to people who kind of dug that kind of weirdo kind of foreign films.
Yeah, or, you know, like, if you're into, like, a certain kind of horror film, like these animal attack kind of things or whatever, I would warn people against this movie if you're very sensitive about dog cruelty. I don't think that there was anything actually done to these dogs that are bad. Of course,
no, you can tell in the dog fight that the dogs are, like, happily playing. Like, you can see one of their, I did notice this. One of the tails was wagging, and they just had, like, it's like red paint or something, but they weren't. They were just, like, playing. It wasn't, like, actual,
right.
Like...
It's still... Stuff. I mean, some of that stuff is still pretty rough to watch. And just implications of it, I think, is going to be really hard for, like, super dog lovers.
No, and I agree with you, and I think that that's a good comment. I didn't think about that. Specifically what I was saying, I did think while I was watching it, I was like, oh, I was like, man, this is kind of brutal. And then I started kind of watching for it. I wonder how they did these fight scenes. And when I was looking for it, I was like, oh, that's how they did this. They just made it sound and look harder than it actually was. Because I don't think that they're just going to have hard-ass dogfights.
Yeah.
In the middle of their movie. But, you know, maybe...
But it's edited. It's edited cleverly enough to make it...
Make the
impact still there.
You're right. I'm just saying, this is very much how I think that they did it. I don't know if it is.
Yeah, no, I would agree with you. Yeah. I felt comfortable in watching it that I didn't think I was watching real animal abuse, but it's convincing enough that it could trigger some people.
No, for sure. I mean, just, I think some of the, I mean, it is, it's, even though we've expressed it like a B movie, there is a really serious, I would say, like, social kind of storytelling that they're talking about. And I mean, there's a really serious story between the mother and the father, and also, like, I mean, the dog goes on a very gritty journey.
Yeah. Like 12 years a dog.
Yeah. And this isn't like, and when we're talking about it's B movie, but a B movie taken as serious as an art house movie.
Right. In that peculiar kind of European filmmaking way.
Yeah. And I was even going to say, if you're kind of into some of the Korean horror, maybe you would kind of tap into this as well.
Yeah, it's good. I enjoyed it quite a bit. What did you have for us next week?
Okay, well, why don't we do something lighter?
Okay.
Like super light as can possible.
Kim Possible?
Kim Possible, yes. The movie. I just saw it. What about this movie, Losers Take All? I don't know anything about it.
Okay.
It's called...
Sounds good.
So this is the synopsis. An indie punk band finally earns a shot at commercial success, but while selling out, kill the credibility and their fun-loving spirit.
I can dig it. Is it a documentary?
It's a movie.
Okay.
Movie.
All right. Sounds good. All right. We'll do that next week then. And if anybody has anything to say about that or White God, if you happen to catch it, or The Visit, and you know, I've said, like I said during my review, there, you know, some people are digging this. So if there's a good argument for it, I want to hear it. Go ahead and email us at jabberinthedrone@gmail.com, or as well, if you have anything to say about our pet topic, about the difference in how narrative is dealt in different mediums. You can also contact us on Facebook and find us there to see other news items that we don't talk about or updates about the show at facebook.com/jabberpodcast. Follow us on Twitter at jabberpodcast, and we might be able to correspond with you. If you have a quick question you want me to answer in the middle of the day, sometimes I look at that. We're also on iTunes and Stitcher Radio, Pocket Cast, Windows Podcast Network, Zune. Follow us there. If you're on iTunes or Stitcher, please leave us a star rating and a 1 or 2 sentence review. We have a couple, more than I thought we had. I actually looked. I think we have 4 reviews. I'd like more. If you do listen to this show, even if you want to leave a negative review, should I say that? Should I encourage
no,
that?
No, don't encourage that. If you have something bad to say, well, just, you know, just say it to yourself.
Thumper.
In the mirror, out loud. Right.
I am less lazy and I've been posting my movie reviews again. I took a few weeks off, but I've been posting my reviews again on saladforkreviews.blogspot.com. So you can read my review of The Visit. It's the last one I posted. I also have some reviews and content up at the Seattle-based movie website, MacGuffin at MacGuff.in/author/Cassidy. Richard had a blog that he once used to write in. Maybe he will again someday.
Yeah, it's not much of a blog. It's a blog, but it's mostly just to kind of be like, yeah, I do stuff with my life.
And it's at rdwally.weebly.com. Be sure to listen to Brad, Amanda, and Alyssa's podcast, Quarter Life Crisis, at quartercrisis.podbean.com. They just uploaded a bunch of interviews that they conducted over the summer. Be sure to listen to Leland over from Olympia, Washington, at his comedy podcast, dampercast.com. And be sure to listen to our friends Patrick and his father over in Detroit at Make Dad Read Comics. Until then, we'll talk to you next week.
Have a good one.
Bye.